Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, the weekly libertarian news and commentary podcast that will never call OSHA on you. I am Matt Welch, joined, as is our custom, here by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Heidi ho, colleagues.
Hey, Matt.
Howdy.
Happy Monday.
We are going to talk about President Joe Biden's far-reaching moves last week to get more Americans vaccinated here in a bit. But first, are you finding it harder than ever to keep up with the news? Frustrated with paywalls? Irritated by clickbait and pop-up ads? Well, imagine an app where you can get unlocked access to the most reliable news sites. An app that filters out mis- and disinformation while presenting every story from multiple perspectives. An app where journalists scour through the headlines from around the world to find stories you wouldn't normally see. An app, in short, that highlights actual good news so you're not trapped in doom-scrolling despair. All this can be yours from an innovative Australian startup called Inkl, I-N-K-L. Inkl.com has forged partnerships with more than 100 news sources, such as The Economist, The Atlantic, and Bloomberg, and created a unique system combining journalists and algorithms to create a best-of news feed. For just 100 simoleons a year, the service gives you access to premium news sites that would otherwise cost you around $12,000. And if you go right the hell now to inkl.com/podcast, they'll give you an additional 25% off. That means you can get a whole year's worth of reliable, headache-free news for just $75. That's inkl.com/podcast. Try it today. You'll be glad you did. Okay, President Joe Biden on Thursday unveiled a six-part plan billed as the path out of the pandemic. Among the most notable of the new rules are a vaccine mandate for all executive branch workers and contractors, a vaccine mandate for all healthcare workers at facilities that receive Medicare or Medicaid funding, which is basically all of them except the ones that don't, and most controversially, another vaccine mandate or weekly testing on the unvaccinated on all private employers in workplaces larger than 100 people, enforced by the Department of Labor's Occupational Safety and Health Administration, otherwise known as OSHA. There are plenty of other aspects of the plan, which we'll get to in a bit. But Catherine, what is your assessment to begin with here about the wisdom of using OSHA to force jab scores of millions of Americans?
I think it is unwise. I think it's a bad idea, Matt. My main thought here is that this is like such a characteristic of what I used to associate with the Obama administration, a little less so with Biden. But this idea that like we extended a hand, we gave you a chance to do the right thing voluntarily. And because you are either deeply misinformed or deeply evil, you didn't see things exactly my way, and now I have no choice but to make my extended hand into a fist and punch you in the face with it. And that,
what's the Obama comp for that?
Just that Obama used to use this rhetoric all the time of like, you know, the open hand, the unclenched fist. He just like had as a rhetorical stance. It was like, I am open and I welcome you to agree with me. And it turns out that that is not what openness is about. It is not, you don't know your pluralism worked when everyone agrees with you. You know your pluralism worked when everyone didn't, and they coexist peacefully. So I guess that's my primary reaction to this news is, you know, I just think it is yet another troubling example of this sort of paternalistic, like I gave you a chance to figure this out on your own, and obviously you're not going to. So my only choice now is to force you via undemocratic executive action.
Nick, Biden said that, quote, this is not about freedom or personal choice. It's about protecting yourself and those around you, unquote. What does that formulation tell you about the president's and about our political moment?
Well, you know, one thing is that Joe Biden is a very plain-speaking, honest guy. He is not lying. He says, you know, in the run-up when he was running for the presidency, he talked about spending $11 trillion in $11 trillion in new spending. And he's doing it. He's, you know, he is saying exactly what he intends to do. And I think in a sense, that's a little bit refreshing, but it's problematic for a number of reasons, some of which Catherine laid out. But, you know, I think we are reaching a kind of vanishing point of maximum government. I hope so, where, you know, the amount of money that we spent over the past 2 years, you know, over $6 trillion in each year, which is amazingly up from, you know, 4.8 or 4.9 trillion just 2 years ago. That's unsustainable. I think Biden understands that, like, he is going to lose and lose big in the midterm elections. The Democrats are going to get wiped out, just as Republicans had in past midterms, et cetera. And this is a question of, you know, just sprinting as far ahead as possible so that when things, the water starts to recede, you've marked a really high water mark. I'm sorry, this is a terrible metaphor.
I get
on it. On the beach. So that when things go back kind of to normal, they're still far, far above where they would have been otherwise. And so in that sense, you know, Joe Biden is stuffing as much into the budget and into, you know, the White House, realm of power as possible. I think this mandate vaccine will be struck down by the courts. But more importantly, I think it's going to fuel resentment, even among people like myself who are vaccinated. I agree with Joe Biden that people should get vaccinated. I agree that most employers probably should, you know, with some exceptions, you know, should be pushing their workers to get vaccinated. You know, vaccines are good. Vaccines are a goddamn great invention that came online much faster than anybody expected, partly because of things Donald Trump did, but mostly because technology and innovation is great. Biden is making it harder and harder for people to see that by acting imperiously.
Peter, we just marked, probably the better word, the 20th anniversary of September 11th. Yeah, let's go with marked.
Yeah, I think that's a better
and
choice.
As part of that, you know, everyone's sort of thinking about the past missteps that got us there and whatnot. Just hearing Nick talk about the extension of all of this called to mind. And don't panic with my meandering wind up here, please.
Called to mind. We always do that.
legal theory. One time it will not end.
I'm going to run out the clock on you bastards. John Yoo, a legal theorist in the Bush administration who came up with sort of a very expansive and kind of unique theory of executive power back in the day. I bring this up because it was controversial. You know, we wrote about it. Everyone was talking about it. It was a subject of controversy. My God, the president is surrounded by people who are coming up with super novel interpretations, twisting existing understandings of the law in order to push through preferred outcomes. I think about this right now because it just sure seems like two things are happening. One is that the Biden administration is doing the same thing. In like, you know, let's have the Centers for Disease Control do an eviction moratorium. Like, that doesn't even begin to make sense legally. So doing the same thing, getting the same advice, except it's not controversial anymore. Like, where is the equivalent outrage at the legal theorists who are telling Joe Biden, no, totally fine, get OSHA on a vaccine mandate?
Yep. That seems right.
All right. That's I can see how this is going. So, all right, Peter. The president also invoked the Defense Production Act to make at-home testing cheaper and more widespread. Seems odd to me that after 18 months of a pandemic, we are using force to try to solve the testing problem. Is this a wise way to go after increasing testing capacity, and or what is your sense of why we screwed it up until this point?
No, it's not wise, and we screwed it up because the FDA screws everything up. So the plan here is that Biden is going to spend $2 billion to help speed the production of 280 million rapid at-home tests. And he's going to also invoke the Defense Production Act again, which was also invoked under President Trump last year, and which Biden invoked earlier this year to help Pfizer, among other vaccine makers, speed up the production of vaccines. And so the goal here is to push 280 million tests out into the market. Now, just think about that number a little bit, and it will tell you how limited this measure is, even if you think it's a great idea, and even if you think it will work really well, which, in fact, a lot of people have looked at this and said, actually, the Defense Production Act isn't really going to help these companies make these tests faster. 280 million. That is less than one test per person per year in the United States, right? And so if you think of rapid testing as a solution, as a mass solution, right, where it the value of it is that you can test yourself every week or every day or every time you're going to go to a concert or an event, and everybody who's going to go to a conference can all show up and test in the morning and again in the evening before they go out with their other conference attendees. If you think of that's the value of rapid testing, if you think of it as that sort of solution, then this doesn't get us anywhere close to it. And the reason we don't have a lot of rapid tests is because the FDA has not approved them. And so we have only a handful of rapid tests available in the United States. There are really only two companies that are producing these things at any sort of scale. You can get them now, which is a better situation than we had last year when you simply could not get rapid at-home testing at all because the FDA thought the tests weren't accurate enough. And so the FDA said, look, these tests are, and they are a little less accurate than PCR tests, the overnights that you might have to go into a clinic for. On the other hand, they have a huge value, which is that you can get them at home. You don't have to go anywhere, and the results show up in 15 minutes. And so right now, we have a situation where you can get, I've actually purchased some of these myself, and it was about $25 for a two-pack. That's not exorbitant. It's not completely unaffordable.
That's a lot of money.
But if you have to do it regularly, it turns out to be a lot of money, especially if you're testing a family. Think of a family of four testing every week or a couple of times a week. You know, people want to go to school. People want to sort of whatever it is they want to do.
People
and they want
to go to school
yes,
so bad.
They do. And whatever it is they want to do.
Parents want kids to go to school.
And it only rapid testing, the value of rapid testing is that you can do a lot of it. And so adding one less than one test per person annually isn't going to get us very far. And the reason we don't have cheap rapid tests is because we have constrained supply, because the FDA has only approved a very small number of them. Compare that with Germany, where there are at least 50 different tests available. And that's why Europe, you see all these stories from Europe, where they can go into stores and purchase tests for just a couple of dollars, and they're widely available. In some cases, there are subsidies as well. But again, approving a lot of tests would make this problem much smaller or would make it go away entirely. And instead, what Joe Biden is doing is spending a lot of money and invoking executive authority that may not help at all.
Catherine, there's been a lot of talk at our site, including by Nick and also by Robbie Suave, Robbie in this case of the New York Times, about how this order, these mandates, and the country's overall policy approach to COVID at this point, kind of degrading social peace and social trust. Can you walk us through that concern and to the extent that you yourself agree with it as a worry?
Yeah, I mean, I think at the core of this actually is the reason critique of over-criminalization or of kind of, you know, the too many laws critique, because at least one way that this is going to degrade social trust and also kind of the idea of rule of law is it's not enforceable. OSHA just has, like, you know, a few hundred dudes who could go out into the field. And I know that there is more money for them. In theory, they're going to bulk up. The timelines don't make any sense. There will be no way to enforce this rule on employers. The idea that employers are going to do it themselves relies on, you know, fear of getting caught. And big employers who have a lot to lose will, I think in most cases, end up doing the work themselves. But there's just like a big chunk of kind of mid-size employers who may very well choose to just not do this and hope it goes away, or hope that the Supreme Court makes it go away, more specifically. I think that that's a terrible situation. It's a terrible situation both for employees and employers, that they are going to be in a kind of legal gray area. And then there's the cultural element. The cultural polarization over vaccination was already well underway. This mandate will not create the polarization. It will worsen it. The people who feared that they would be forced to do this before they were ready, their fears have now all but been proven true. And this is, you know, I question whether the long-term consequences of not only doing this as a mandate, having it enforced privately, and also, you know, doing it still out of sequence with full vaccine approvals. Like, keep in mind that we are still waiting for full approvals and for, of course, approvals for kids on many of these vaccines. And just the total, you know, double talk of, you know, the government knows what is best. The government will tell you what to do. The government has not yet finished deciding about some of these vaccines. Also, the booster guidance is wildly unclear at this point. And by the way, keep masking. You're going to get in trouble for that, too. Like, this is not a good way to heal from whatever rifts you might blame Donald Trump for or think Donald Trump is a symptom of. And from just the general disaster of the last year, it's going to make a bunch of those polarizations worse.
I think the enforcement and polarization issues are actually related, because the enforcement, as Catherine said, is not going to be broad and consistent. There's just not enough manpower to do it. Instead, it's going to be kind of random and inconsistent. And since they can't enforce it broadly, you have to presume that what they're going to end up doing is just making an example out of some company that is outspoken in resistance.
And that is a great way to get conspiracy theories going, right? Like, if you are like asking the question, why did the vaccine mandate get enforced here and not here? It will be so easy to fit that into any number of pre-existing conspiracy theories, especially on the part of two of the populations that this is supposed to be targeting, which is, you know, conservative Republicans in red states and Black Americans, who have already like a prefab conspiracy theory ready to go about why this vaccine might be being forced on them. And this is going to make that worse.
Oh, I was going to say, you know, one is to look at the vaccine pushback here. And in the past, vaccines were, generally speaking, mandated vaccines, which typically were aimed at kids going to school, were not as controversial as they were. If you go back to, you know, pre-21st century America, I mean, there were times where things like the polio vaccine were somewhat controversial, especially when they had big fuck-ups early on. But there was more trust. There was more confidence. The process was probably not more public, but it followed public opinion more than tried to bludgeon it into things. But the vaccine pushback, 10, 15 years ago, liberals were more likely to be anti-vaccine than conservatives, according to Pew. What we're seeing now is a flaring up on both sides. And Catherine has a piece up about horseshoe theory on the website from the latest issue of the magazine that just went up today. You know, you're seeing an exacerbation on the right and the left because people don't trust government. And we don't trust government for good reasons, which leads me to, I think the policy intervention here is to take a page from the 2009 Domino's pizza campaign, where Domino's CEO came on and said, hey, you know what? We're sorry. Our pizza has absolutely sucked for most of our lives, you know, most of our corporate lives. We are sorry, and we're going to do better. And here's a bunch of incentives to try our shitty pizza again, now that we're taking it more seriously. That's the kind of mea culpa and reset that the government needs to do. And specifically the FDA and the CDC, which, you know, you can focus on insane people who are just going to be nuts all the time. When you look at the reaction to things that the government, whether under Trump or Biden, but the FDA and the CDC were leading, they have been really, really bad at what they are explicitly supposed to be doing, which is controlling a pandemic and giving public health information and guidance. And like there needs to be a kind of public recognition of that if we are actually going to start rebuilding trust and confidence in major parts of the government that are now telling us not just, you know, what we can wear, but also you got to get this thing stuck in your arm. It's like a big deal. And everybody is just kind of acting as if, no, you know, it's just recalcitrant people, whether it's Blacks or conservative, you know, Christians. Like, you know, these are just problems. They're not the problem. The problem is what the FDA and the CDC has done over the past couple of years.
Sounds like we need a trust and reconciliation commission, Nicholas.
Let's get one of those.
Trust would be nice. Truth, we know, is subjective.
Unobtainable. I also find the continued comparisons between school vaccine mandates and this mandate for private employers to be disingenuous and irritating. Like, the idea that it is the same thing to say for young children to participate in schooling, we would require them to get these, you know, long existing proven vaccines. And hey, we're going to make Walmart our vaccine police for grownups. Like, those are really different things. And I think you might be like, listen, both are justified or neither are justified. But the notion that, you know, and my Twitter feed is full of this, people waving away objections to this vaccine mandate because, like, somewhere some vaccine has been mandated for some population before. This is a novel way of doing this, and it is worth more scrutiny than a month ago, basically everyone in the administration saying we will not do a mandate, and then, you know, this week saying no, we decided it's fine. At least I suppose we can be grateful that maybe Biden learned from his CDC mistake about the eviction moratorium and didn't say out loud, we're pretty sure this is unconstitutional, but we're going to do it anyway and wait for the courts to tell us it's not. But it seems to be the same basic legal theory.
So I think it's actually a little different. The CDC was concocting a truly novel new power for itself that also was completely unbounded. And OSHA, this is not a defense of this, but there is an argument to be made that OSHA has had a kind of workplace safety mandate that covers things potentially like diseases in the past, and that this is like one or two extra steps rather than like we ran the extra mile. And again, I'm not saying that I think that this is that I think it's a good idea, and I think it's certain to be challenged in court. I do think it's not quite the legal stretch that the CDC mandate was. And depending on how they write the rule, there is at least a chance that some version of this ends up being legal. That doesn't make it a good idea, to be clear. And I think the sort of the underlying problem, we can get caught up in like talking about the legalistic stuff about like whether OSHA's statute actually allows it to, right? Like, and we could totally go down that path, but let's not do that. I think the problem is OSHA shouldn't be doing this, period. Like, that shouldn't be part of OSHA's brief, right? Their remit should not be to be America's vaccine mandate supervisors, in which they like determine whether or not Walmart and Apple are actually like enforcing are being our national vaccine cops.
Also, let's just please keep going and be like, maybe OSHA shouldn't be doing anything, like at all.
Wow.
Just a reminder from your friendly neighborhood anarchist.
It's part of Richard Nixon's greatest legacy. So.
Y'all, I know we need to move on, Matt. I do want to just very quickly say I learned something on Twitter this week because of this week's news. Apparently, no one else calls the sound that trucks make when they back up the OSHA beep. My family calls it that. I thought that was a thing. Twitter says no. And then I was like, maybe it's just a beltway thing. Nope, Twitter says no. So I think it should be called that. Personally, because people hate those beeps, right? It's like it's freaking 5 a.m. The trash truck is outside going beep, beep, beep. Like, associate that with OSHA and make people mad. Thank you. The end.
We're going to go there. I just want to register my complaint now that New York decided that today was the day to get like 8 Mack trucks and like a skip loader and an asphalt scraper on the one little narrow block. At which there's a gigantic elementary school on one side of the street and two other private schools on the other side of the street, all of which were having their opening day of school.
Sure. Like,
absolutely.
They definitely shouldn't have done that during the summer. That wouldn't have made any sense.
The entire summer. It was fantastic. A couple of tying up loose ends notes. One, to Catherine's point about using the school vaccines as some kind of analog. It's always worth remembering in this context that unlike your measles and other such diseases, this one just disproportionately, thank God, doesn't really affect children very negatively and very much at all, period. So it's just not the same level of infectious scare, despite all of the unremittent scare stories out there. that you see in the media, most notably, and Nick, I think, flagged this on Twitter, as did I, Lester Holt at NBC News. It's like, tonight, emergency scare for our children in schools. Like, incredibly irresponsible media panicking about all that kind of stuff. Another note on that, the LA Unified School District passed a vaccine mandate for kids 12 and over last week, which is some kind of interesting new step. It had been played out in Culver City, which is a much smaller school district in California. But I wonder if it's going to create a lot of push a lot of reluctant parents into going into remote learning, which has been a disaster. And then the final thing, again, going into what Catherine was saying before about the punitive nature of some of this plan. It's actually spelled out in the Biden 6-point plan, like we're going to double fines for people who don't wear masks on, you know, domestic transit. And we're going to go after and try to sue governors who have passed mandates to not have masking in schools, regardless of what one thinks about that particular policy. There's just a punitive and partisan nature about all of this. Joe Biden gave a speech on Thursday at a school with Dr. Jill Biden, in which began a paragraph, short paragraph, saying, and this is nearly a direct quote, that the governors out there, Republican governors, they just don't seem to care about our children dying. And then later on in the same paragraph said, you know, I want to tell the kids, it hasn't always been like this. Politics hasn't always been this sort of blood sport where everyone just makes these accusations about one another. It's the tone deafness is pretty astonishing. All right. I'm going to force change the subject. Congress is back in session today, preparing President Biden's $3.5 trillion budget, his $550 billion everything is infrastructure bill. And obviously raising the debt limit and so forth. As part of this, the Ways and Means Committee in the House, which what I understand is that's where you originate tax and spending bills, at least historically, they have begun releasing details of a massive new proposed tax hike. This includes raising the corporate tax rate from 21% to 26.5%, the capital gains tax from 20% to 25%, and wealth tax for people who earn $5 million and up. There are a bunch of smaller beer items as well, and I want to actually start there, maybe to wrap our heads around it, with Catherine's reaction on a plan to squeeze $95 billion more out of nicotine products. Is that a good idea, Catherine? And is it consistent with Joe Biden's frequent claims on the campaign trail that he would not raise taxes one dime on people who make less than $400,000 a year?
It is definitely not consistent with that pledge. It's so weird how politicians keep saying they're not going to raise taxes or not going to raise taxes on some subgroup of people, and then they spend so much money that at some point, someone somewhere is like, are you at least going to kind of like pretend to pay for some of this? And then they're like, okay, well, here's the thing. We're going to have to go back on that other promise. The thing that's going to be frustrating is that Biden is somehow going to say that this isn't going back on that promise. Like, I haven't seen that statement yet, but at some point, someone's going to be like, hey, didn't you say you weren't going to tax the poor? It seems like the poor sometimes smoke the cigarettes. What the hell, man? And he is going to say a big, dumb word salad that is not going to answer that question and is going to be about, like, corn pop or something. And it's going to be infuriating, because what it will be is that he lied and broke a promise. And that is something that politicians should be held accountable for. Of course, also, I am, not too psyched about new sin taxes to cover spending on stuff that I don't think the government should be spending on. I was chatting this morning with Reason Foundation Minister of Sin. I don't know what his actual title is.
I think it's that.
Is that?
We've got a lot of good jobs here at Foundation.
I wish.
We're never going to hire more than 100 people.
Do you think that I can like get a title with sin in it? Because I would like that, actually. It's implied. You think so? Guy Bentley, who was talking with me about the fact that, you know, he has been in touch with folks who run vape shops, also under siege at the moment on a couple of different fronts, and that there's really just this broad spectrum of responses, which include people saying, I'm just going to keep my shop open and screw the rules. And I do think we are going to see more people who are, you know, trying to find ways to dodge these taxes, either as consumers or as sellers. And this gets us right back to the place of don't punitively tax or criminalize behavior that you're not willing to ultimately have a cop put someone's, you know, put someone's life on the line for. I really, you know, don't mean to go full crazy libertarian. I guess I already did that in this podcast. But the increase of all of these sort of genteel taxes on rich people are one thing, and they are bad. But, you know, there's a reason that we try not to increase taxes on people who don't have a lot of resources. And it's because they're desperate and it will be even harder for them and harder to enforce those taxes.
I do love how the line for who's going to have their taxes raised is always set equal to like a senior White House advisor married to a congressional chief of
staff.
Right.
Like, it's amazing how like it's like a, you know, the government pay scale like indexes very neatly to who's rich. Yeah.
You know, one of the things when you look at the early discussions of the tax hikes that Biden is pushing, you know, this is like, you know, $3 trillion, $2.9 trillion over the coming decade. I think the complexity of them is the point, almost, where, you know, there used to be people on every side of the issue about taxes at least would say, you know, taxes should be simplified so that people understand what they're doing. Because if taxes, you know, it makes it harder to avoid them. If taxes are simple and widely understood and kind of easy to implement and follow. And also the idea is that if taxes are going to actually try to change behavior, which I think is awful, and I miss the 90s when a big debate over taxes was, and libertarians were constantly, you know, yelling at conservatives and liberals, you should not be using the tax code to change people's behavior. That's an incorrect way to structure society. We're back there, but nobody is talking about it because people on the right and the left have given up the idea of actually using suasion. They want to use government force. But the complexity, when you look at some of the tax breaks or tax credits for things like electric vehicles, for electric bikes, for a whole host of things, it gets super complicated super quickly. And this is, you know, again, it's almost like, I don't think Biden is running a conspiracy. I don't think he is an evil genius. I think he is the predictable endpoint of this long slog towards a kind of Neal Stephenson level or style state where everything is regulated, everything is controlled. Nobody is quite sure what's going on. And we're, you know, we're still supporting tobacco farmers while raising taxes on nicotine products. You know, it's like when the Vatican did an audit in the 80s and they found out, you know, among other things, the Vatican owned massive interests in like condom factories and birth control, you know, companies. It's just vast and overwhelming. None of it makes sense. And the complexity just beats people into a vague kind of submission because you know you are always wrong. And that things are always going to leave you in a place where you can be singled out and, you know, according to the letter of the law, be brought into the dock and have to pay a fine or worse.
There is a, Nick alluded to the electrical vehicle tax credit. Speaking of genteel portion of the electorate out there, it's up to $7,500 in this proposal, as well as an e-bike credit of $1,500. So it looks that Democrats really took that income inequality, Thomas Piketty stuff really to heart. And so they're going to finally get money in the pockets of people who prefer Priuses.
The e-bike, you know, refund only or tax break only comes on bikes up to $8,000. You know, so the really wealthy people, Matt, won't get that.
That's
because
true.
They'll probably buy e-bikes that are, you know, $9,000.
There is this person, right? You can really paint a portrait at this point of a person who is going to now be set up. Like by the end of the Biden administration, there is someone who had $100,000 in student loans to get like a journalism degree, who has, you know, an e-bike and an electric vehicle and like who just has dollars like raining down on him somehow in the name of social justice and environmental progressivism. And it's garbage. It's just like it's absolutely, even if you grant all of the supposed premises of the Democratic Party's policy agenda and tax agenda, like this doesn't do that. This doesn't do the thing that you say you want to do.
There is a payroll tax credit.
A lot of these things phase out. I'm sorry, just very quickly. A lot of these things don't phase out until you're talking about people who make 400 grand a year, families or households that make 800,000 grand a year. And you can hear people in Washington being like, you know, $400,000 is not a lot of money for a single filer, you know, where I live.
It's like those amazing Forbes features that we've talked about on this podcast before, where it's like, why does this family earn, you know, $500,000 and still feel poor? And it's like, because
they're assholes.
Because the boat costs a lot of money. Like, I don't know how else to explain it.
Yes, if you go to Europe first class 3 times a year.
Yeah, then you use up all your dollars on stuff.
Peter, I heard you winding up about the payroll tax a little bit.
I was actually just going to say that my favorite little tidbit that I have discovered in this bill via our colleague Christian Britschke is that the tax plan includes a tax break for local newspapers. So I guess, does that include the New York Times, which is local in New York? I don't know. but it is a tax credit for payroll taxes that they pay their journalists. So now the New York Times is going to have to define what, not the New York Times is going to have to define, the now Congress is going to have to define what counts as a local paper and who counts as a journalist for tax purposes.
It really does blow my mind that anybody anywhere in this ecosystem is like, what we need is more direct involvement by the federal government in funding, defining, categorizing local journalism. Like, do we not read history? Like, are we pretending we don't know about like state news services and how those go? Like, we're just not.
So I want to know if this applies to people who run very successful Substacks and then hire employees, right? Ooh. And so in fact, there are some Substacks that are multi-employee.
But it won't. Like, it clearly won't, but just because arbitrarily it won't.
But in fact, Substack is investing in local news, and that is literally one of their priority areas for growth.
Like, you can say words, but like, it won't.
Among the people who are advocating for this is one of my least favorite columnists in the world, and I always like to just invoke
her name
and
right here,
say that,
Matt.
Kathleen Sullivan from the Washington Post. Who used to be the ombudsman of the New York Times and the editor in chief of the Buffalo News or something like that, and who's written a book recently about the death of local news and why that's a problem. And that's, you know, that is an interesting argument and thing to pay attention to. But the solution for it of having the federal government in kind of an up and down must pass cromnibus bill, no less. Let's just slip it in there. A little Save Local Journalism Act can't possibly go wrong. It's amazing. And the lack of scrutiny by journalists about this thing is kind of a chef's kiss type of arrangement.
Matt, okay, do you mean Margaret Sullivan?
Margaret Sullivan. Oh, I always say Kathleen. I know a Kathleen Sullivan. I'm sorry, Kathleen. Mm. I didn't mean that. She's actually the... goddaughter to one of my kids, but that wasn't on purpose. Okay, sorry. Anyways, we're going to get to our email of the week here in a moment. But first, living in a digital age where your personal data is always under attack, you might think that online privacy was a thing of the past. Well, think again. Did you know that there's a better way to protect your information and privacy without worrying about the prying eyes of big tech mining and profiting from your private information? Introducing Secure, encrypted instant messaging and secure email service hosted in Switzerland, where the world's strictest data privacy laws are in effect. By using military-grade encryption methods, a proprietary platform, and servers hosted in Switzerland, Secure protects your data from the invasive Cloud Act and other privacy-violating laws. Your email and instant messaging services will be safe from big tech platforms such as Amazon Web Services, Facebook, WhatsApp, Microsoft, Google. Take back your privacy and online security with Secure by going to secure.com. That's SEKUR.com. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right, reminder, keep sending your great emails to roundtable@reason.com. This one, which is extra special for reasons that you're going to hear in half a moment, comes from Michael Zelli from the great city of Baltimore, Maryland. He writes, "Hello, roundtablers. In the August 9th edition of this fine podcast, keep it up, Catherine graciously suggested the Emily Oster book. By month's end, I found out that I am going to be a new father." Woo! Yes. "And can place her suggestion to use next year. My question to all of you is, as someone who entered the realm of libertarian ideals through growing up in endless wars against terror, drugs, and the like, how do I effectively teach these ideals to my coming child? Should I be reading Ayn Rand, Cribside?" I'm gonna stop you there. I mean, I guess when you're trying to make him go to sleep. Or do you have better recommendations? Is there hope that they may grow into a world of more effective and smaller government? Or should I mold them into the pragmatic anarchist image of Catherine Mangue Ward? Thank you, Michael Zelli." Catherine, you've been invoked. I guess you get first right to talk about your children's book.
I will not be writing a children's book. Always make more me's, I guess, if you can. But that's a tough one. I personally have already resigned myself to the fact that my children will be running away and joining the kibbutz, because that seems to me to be like the perfect combination of like I am respectful of, but, skeptical of religions of all kinds. And also of the socialism. So obviously your best bet is going to be a kibbutz if you want to piss off mom. I'm zen about that. I think that, kids are who they are. Attempting to shape their politics too directly is more likely to backfire than anything else. That said, I think a lot of parenting is just about figuring out how to make parenting more fun for you, the parent. This is from both Brian Kaplan and also Emily Oster, that kids really are who they are. And as long as you're above a bare minimum, you're just getting them through till they become themselves. But I find that parenting is more fun for me if I read my kids books that I like and like the themes of. And luckily, there are lots of good children's books that are about being, at base skeptical of authority and about not relying on, truth givers with the sort of stamp of, the past on them. And, there's plenty of dystopias out there. So I think as long as you avoid the rainbow fish, you're putting
the giving tree,
you're putting your kid on a path to success just by, being a Reason fan, letting those ideas be out there in the household. But yeah, definitely if you try too hard, it's going to blow up in your face. That's my parenting lesson, if I have one at all.
I do think in the spirit of making parenting more enjoyable for the parents, baby bum fights, always a good idea. Whenever you have play dates or in pods, you can do it.
Yeah.
I will simply say my kids, I realize now why the lure of your children being their own people is so seductive, because when they turn a certain age, you want to absolve yourself of all responsibility for them.
But that's empirically valid.
The odds are probably true that if they're successful, they're not going to give you a lot of the money anyway. So it's really, it's a kind of Pascal's wager that you can't lose. But I never, and my kid's mother as well, who's an anarchist, I never talked about stuff like this. And I would just, when they would come home and talk about stuff, I'd be like, oh, that's interesting. What do you think of this? And then you leave. I mean, Catherine was alluding to this young adult fiction, assuming your kids are going to be readers. It's like, it's all dystopias. So you don't have to do the work at all. You just have to make sure that you've saved a couple of copies of The Hunger Games and The Giver when Joe Biden's literacy police have, vaporized all of them and made Amazon pull them off of everyone's Kindles once and for all. Those sacred scripts will be around and they'll be in new form in another 5 or 10 or 15 years.
I will say very annoyingly, one thing that seems to correspond highly these days to younger people that Reason wants to hire, which is at least one metric you might be interested in, is homeschooling. And as someone who has a gosh darn job and whose husband has a gosh darn job, that is extremely difficult to figure out how to execute. But like we got a lot of homeschool kids up in here. So I think that might be one part of the answer. If you are really looking to put your thumb on the scale, is like maybe don't send them to normal school.
I have perhaps similar to Nick, a pretty strong allergy to trying to, you know, indoctrinate or impart any kind of philosophy on the kids. Because part of it is that you don't want to sow the backlash later. And I've probably mentioned this one time in the past, but when my oldest, who is now 13, was closer to six, I would say, she asked me what were taxes. And my answer was,
big deep breath.
Taxes are what the government takes from you in order to do things like build the roads. Like I went all the, you know, maintain the bridges, do the things that the government feels like it has the function to do that are kind of group activity. I tried to be as neutral as humanly possible. I could have been, you know, almost Center for American Progress level of description. And she thought about it for a second. She said, so it's like stealing.
I mean,
tried really hard not to fist pump. But yeah.
Did you see that thing that was going around on Twitter? I can't actually remember now the source of it, but it was like explaining the idea of American style taxation to the Afghan people.
Yeah.
And it was like, we went around and we were explaining about taxes. And we were like, well, it's, you know, you give the money and then we spend it and we spend it on what we choose. And it was like, it's stealing. Like it, yeah, like, oh yeah, we know about that. Like people have been stealing from us for millennia here. Like that's not a new thing y'all invented. It's just like there is this natural human response to the idea of taxation, which is that it's theft. Like it's like deeply annoying to me that people are like, you wackadoodle anarchists with your taxation. No, everyone knows it's theft. Some people just think it's like theft. They're going to accept, I guess, but it's still theft. I don't say that stuff to my children because I'm trying to play it cool like everyone here. I mean, this is, you know, this is the libertarian way. It's like you really feel super strongly about your weird politics and also feel super strongly that not everyone has to share your weird politics. And
so your kids don't listen to the podcast?
Tough one. Yeah. Can you imagine? They listen to a podcast that are like... I've recommended them on this very podcast. They listen to Greek mythology and weird science facts, as it should be.
One thing that happens, and Catherine might be there already, I'm certainly there with the oldest one, is that you end up playing defense once they age into a certain level. And all you're trying to do is to encourage them not to make drastic, all-encompassing judgments all the time about various people, whether it is that, you know, J.K. Rowling is a transphobe or whatever. Try to encourage them to think, well, you know, a lot of different people think a lot of different things about this, and maybe you shouldn't put this one in cement. I don't know if that's helpful at all. Peter, your parents were obviously tried to indoctrinate you early into libertarianism down in the libertarian state of Florida.
No, totally the opposite. I mean, no one should try to replicate me. Unlike Catherine, there should be, just don't make more of me. But if for some reason you wanted to, the main thing would be that you never mention libertarianism at all. Like never, ever.
Yeah. Actually, that's the same formula for me. Like
right.
The word was not said in my house.
But so. what I also got I don't know whether you got this, was that I was raised in a house full of like quiet political conflict with an evangelical conservative ex-hippie mom and a softly liberal quasi-Mennonite English professor who also hated Al Gore dad. And they never talked about politics with each other, but then alone we would get to hear a little bit about their political views, which were always framed as, but your mother and I disagree, or your father and I disagree about this. And so it was just like I grew up with the knowledge of political conflict, of like the fact that I didn't have to be trained that like some other people think this way, because in my house there were people
some
who
other
thought
people were
very, very different
way.
Ways. But the other thing they did, and I actually think this really matters, is that like some non-trivial percentage of my ideology just comes from reading an absolute ton of science fiction. And science fiction trains you to extrapolate into the future about technology, society, and government. And like the ideas of libertarianism are built into science fiction, even into quite lefty, quite technocratic science fiction. I've been rereading Isaac Asimov's Foundation books. And, you know, I read those things when I was 8 or 9 years old. And if you read them at that young age and have the idea that like, the future could be different and there are different ways to organize society and like politics and engineering and culture are going to kind of come into conflict in a bunch of ways. And you're just always thinking about that. Then I sort of think you end up being somebody who is, if maybe you don't end up as a libertarian, but you end up at least open to libertarian ways of thinking, because so much of Republican Party and Democratic Party and sort of mainstream conservative and mainstream liberal thinking is status quo, static thinking that just doesn't really consider unintended consequences and the fact that technology advances and changes and the ways that governance can interact with culture and technology.
This all brings me to mind the greatest single book project that I've never completed, and you'll understand why in a half a second. It was a joint project dreamed up on Twitter for half an afternoon with, speaking of homeschoolers, Lucy Steigerwald, the beloved ex-reasoner, and Ken Lane, the insane person who lives in the desert somewhere. It was supposed to be a children's book called Every President is Terrible. and it's still a great idea. What? If someone decides to...
Like, is there a thesis?
Each president gets a treatment, you know. George Washington is the father of our country. He did this, he did this. Also, George Washington, turn the page, was terrible. And then you go on. Obviously, it's a great idea. And we'll never get done. Okay, speaking of great culture that gets done and gets consumed, let's go to our end of show. What the hell have you been watching, listening to, reading, and et cetera? Catherine, do you want to start off for us?
Yeah. I read a novel called Notes of a Crocodile. It is by Qiu Maojin. It's set in Taipei in the late 1980s. And it is about, it's sort of a coming of age, multimedia-ish book. And it's about being a lesbian in Taiwan in the late 80s. And in particular, the ways in which that really, really messes up our protagonist, who is almost certainly a sort of thinly veiled autofiction version of the author herself, who committed suicide at age 26, not so long after the publication of this book. And it's really dark. I really, really struggled to finish this book. I read it as part of a book club. Otherwise, I almost certainly would have abandoned it out of cowardice because the book is horrible. And the reason that I'm recommending it here is, I guess, actually like a weird kind of optimism that it really is a reminder that specific elements in the law, right? This was like a state, it was a state prohibition on homosexual conduct in Taiwan at this time. There was a sort of a moral panic about it. Shortly after the book was really released, I think in English, there was a huge national television special where a reporter went undercover into a lesbian bar and showed like all of the patrons' faces, and like the entire country just like went into an uproar. The crocodile of the title is that there is this sort of bizarre interspersed story of, you know, this idea that there are crocodiles in human suits among us, and like they're sort of desperate attempts to hide themselves, which is of course a metaphor for homosexuality in this society. Taiwan was relatively on the kind of earlier vanguard of liberalizing laws around homosexuality and legalizing it in East Asia. And it's just a reminder that laws can ruin people's lives, and that changing those laws can dramatically, dramatically better, particularly, you know, minorities' lot. I mean, this is a woman who clearly was very, very troubled, but the environment in which she lived led to this like darkness in her soul, and it was it was imposed by outsiders at the point of a gun. And so I guess I just want to like take a minute and be happy that though there's a lot of work yet to be done, like we don't do that here anymore and they don't do that there anymore. And this incredibly talented writer maybe could have lived and written more if she had been just born a little bit later. So Notes on the Crocodile, really got to be in the mood for it, y'all. Like, it's dark, but also very beautifully written and moving.
Nick, what kind of darkness have you been mining?
Well, you know, I don't know. Depending on your point of view, this was either a dark film or an uplifting film. But I watched a new documentary called The Lost Leonardo, which is directed by Andreas Cooper. I'm mispronouncing their name. But what it is about is in the early 2000s, two art dealers discovered a painting that they thought might be a Leonardo or a copy of a Leonardo da Vinci painting. They paid $1,175 for it at an auction at a small place in New Orleans. It ended up in 2017 selling at Sotheby's for $450 million after it has been restored to Mohammed bin Salman of MBS of Saudi Arabia, who then tried to get it displayed in time in 2019 for the 500th anniversary of Leonardo's birth or death, I forget at the current moment. And that kind of went haywire, but then he gifted it to the Louvre in Abu Dhabi. And so what this documentary is about is how this painting moved from being, you know, in essentially a rummage sale in New Orleans to being almost displayed at the Louvre and now being in a, you know, the masterpiece. Salvatore Mundi it's a picture of Jesus and it's attributed to Leonardo. There's still some real questions about that and the provenance of it all. It's an incredible story about art markets. It's an incredible story about political power and soft power because MBS is trying to use this painting as a way of kind of projecting himself not simply into world politics, but into world cultural elites. It tells a story from a capitalist point of view about why is a painting, you know, if it's attributed to exactly the same thing, if it is a Leonardo, it's worth $450 million. If it is a copy of a Leonardo, or if it is done by one of his, flunkies in a studio, it's worth $2,000. There's a leftist reading of that. There's also a fantastic kind of set of capitalist readings. So this is it's a detective story. It is extremely well done and it's just provocative as hell. So I recommend anybody who's interested in the subjective value of theory, world politics, and kind of hating on elite culture at the same time. The Lost Leonardo is a phenomenal documentary.
It sounds tailor-made for Nick Gillespie, the way you just described it. Peter, what have you been consuming?
I read Beautiful World, Where Are You? It is the third novel by Sally Rooney. It's a wonderful and thoroughly engaging, often incredibly romantic look at love and beauty and politics. And it's also a defense of the novel and the idea of art. So I've talked about Rooney on this podcast a couple of times before. She is young, Irish, and notably a Marxist. And there are Marxist ideas.
Those are three strikes. Sure. Why are we still talking?
Because she's really good. And I actually want to, like, her Marxism is interestingly in tension with this book, I think, because there are Marxist ideas discussed throughout the novel, sometimes quite explicitly. Sometimes it's just sort of in imagistic pairings. But the book is a defense of beauty, both natural and created. It's a defense of individuality and the value of relationships and that feeling of awe that you get both when you are in the presence of someone you love and also when you are enthrall to sort of a piece of art, something that has been created that is wonderful and excellent, a novel or a painting. And in that way, I think it kind of undermines some of her sort of stated Marxist ideals, because Marxism is, I think, ultimately built around a sort of soul-crushing sameness, a deadening and brutalizing kind of equality, right? That doesn't really value individuality or specific human attributes and relationships. And her book is not that, because it recognizes, her book recognizes that everyone is different, and that it is that in their difference that that wonder is created. And so each person brings something unique and beautiful to the world and expresses it in their own way. And that's sort of her core outlook on life and relationships and art and books. And it's just, it's a super, super engaging, fast, enjoyable read if you like contemporary fiction.
Yeah, I think Rooney's appeal, she gets written up mostly in lefty magazines because she's, you know, an immensely popular novel in the English-speaking world. And her politics, she wears them on her sleeves. But her work is really a performative contradiction to a lot of the thoughts that the characters in her works that seem to be speaking for her actually espouse. And I think that's the tension that is drawing readership. It's not that she is merely like a really good writer, particularly of dialogue, who is espousing, you know, warmed over Marxist platitudes.
So last night I violated one of my tweeting laws, which is never retweet something that's been tweeted a lot. But there was an image that was going around of a young man with his dog in 1940, France, saying, you know, today's September 12th, 1940, a dog found a little, you know, a hole in the ground. And then this guy dropped some stuff in it. And eventually this became the discovery of the Lascaux caves, the great cave painting caves, which I visited. It's great. I retweeted it and said something to that effect, that it's awesome. Also, the dog's name is Robot. So I was very curious, speaking of Isaac Asimov, I was very curious, why does a Frenchman name a dog Robot in 1940? I'd say, yeah, that's very
curious.
Because
he's a Carol Chapek fan.
Well, so I was rewarded doubly by tweeting this, because one person said, as a matter of fact, Karel Čapek's play or something.
It's a play, R.U.R.
Yeah.
R.U.R. was
Rossum's
put on.
Rossum's Universal Robots.
Was put on in France in the 30s or something and became popular. So most likely came from there. But I was mostly rewarded, and this is what I'm going to recommend to people who have a similar bent. Someone said, oh, then you must have seen the Werner Herzog documentary about the Chauvet Caves in France. And I was like, bring me the Werner Herzog. This man with, what is he saying from across the void? So I obviously excitedly went to my wife and said,
are we
going to
actually like splice in that clip? Or are you... Or are we just going to leave it there?
I
want to
leave.
Splicing the clip
I would
in
like
with your
to
voice.
Leave Matt's version, please.
I mean,
petition to
just
leave Matt's
seriously,
version.
All you want is Werner Herzog to be inside of a cave saying, silence, please, so we can hear maybe just the heartbeat. It's so good. It's exactly what you want, including a coda at the end involving albino alligators near a nuclear plant for no particular reason. It's great. He was allowed to go into the cave, which is sealed off from the public, for 4 or 5 days by the Minister of Culture, who they knew what they were doing. And he looked around at the stuff. Really beautiful depictions and drawing. They're 30,000 years old. There's a bison female at some point. There's rhinos and tigers and horses and stuff. And the music of it is really great and weird. And it ends up being, without being explicit about it, you can imagine, knowing Werner Herzog, that it's kind of a celebration of civilization. This great sort of early expression of civilization, including, you know, at some point it looks like the legs of some animals, of a bison, they draw like 8 legs. It is like proto cinema on it. So it's all great, interesting. It's a pay into European civilization. And since that movie came out, which is 2011 or 2010, they have apparently created a recreation of the cave that you can go visit out there in southwestern France. And I'm sure it must be stunning. Judging by visiting also the recreation at the Lascaux Caves, which I did a couple of years ago, I can't recommend it high enough. It is genuinely moving to see these sort of depictions out there. So, Cave of Forgotten Dreams.
It's really called that.
It's called Cave of Forgotten Dreams.
Wow.
I says to my wife, like, we got to stop what we're doing. We got to go watch the Werner Herzog Cave of Forgotten Dreams. Come on. And weirdly, she didn't take me up on it, but I watched it and I loved it. So anyway, so those are all the forgotten dreams that we have time for on the Reason Roundtable podcast. Look for all of our podcast offerings at reason.com/podcasts, including especially the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie. And we will catch you next week. Goodbye.